Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and I'm very excited about our Paradigm Shifter tonight, Jim Emke, who can, well, I don't know, he has so much knowledge about nutrition and your body, mind, and deteriorations of the body and rebuilding of the body. It's just exciting. We're going to have him on more than once because he just knows so much about you. It'll surprise you. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Well, thank you, Veronica. I'm glad to be here.
I'm so excited to talk to you. And how did you get into nutrition? My goodness, you know so much.
Well, actually, it was a combination of sheer desperation and opportunity, I think. I was pretty ill as a kid. I had chronic boils for 10 years, from basically puberty to my early 20s. And I mean boils that left scars on my body. And, you know, I don't know if you know what a boil is, but it's a skin eruption that's like a really, really nasty zit that is staph infected.
I did have some for my 40th birthday, huge ones.
Well, then you know. And, I mean, I got so tired of going to doctors and having them lance boils. My parents got tired, and I developed my own little surgical techniques to cut open my own boils using sterilized needles and things. You know, I was like 12 years old.
Wow.
But I was desperate. And they thought I had leukemia, and it was blood tests and this and that, and it was just nothing. So and my grandma was right all along. She said, Jimmy, you just got poisons in your blood. So then I met Mr. Irons. V.E. Irons was an iconic figure in the 50s and 60s and 70s in this field. Victor Earl Irons, veirons.com.
Is I-R-O-N-S?
I-R-O-N-S, correct. He was, at the time when I met him in 1972, I was 22 and he was 78 and he looked like he was in his 50s. I mean, he was a living dynamo. He eventually died years later at 98 years of age after complications from an automobile accident.
Oh, wow.
And Mr. Irons was just an amazing man. He his first wife died young when he remarried when he was 72 and his wife was 28. And he and Julia Irons had a second family, and Mr. Irons fathered his last son when he was 80.
Oh, gosh.
And then when he died at 98 years of age, he had two daughters in their 20s and an 18-year-old son and a 76-year-old son from his first marriage.
So, now, that's got to be a record of some sort.
I went to his talk with my grandpa, who was my, you know, kind of like my mentor of that era, and a really wonderful person, and he tried to convince me that it was definitely the milkman. You know, Mr. Irons had no way fathered any children. He was in his late 70s and 80s.
Didn't Charlie Chaplin do some of that?
I think he did, too, yeah.
Yeah.
Remember when we used to have milkmen, right?
Oh, yeah. So he was really a nutritional wizard, was he?
Well, he was in his 40s. He was a real successful businessman, and in his 40s, he developed ankylosing spondylitis, which is...
oh, my, that's...
Yeah, rheumatoid arthritis of the spinal column.
Isn't that what Norman Cousins had?
That might be. Gosh, Norman Cousins, The Anatomy of an Illness. What a great story that is, you know, for another time, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember exactly what Cousins had, but that's what Irons had. They called it Marie Strumpel arthritis. It was named after, I guess, a woman named Marie Strumpel. But he doctored and doctored and didn't get anywhere, and then finally he met Paul Bragg. And Paul Bragg, of course, is another iconic figure in this field who was like the king of the natural health world, you know, through the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, and finally died at like 106 when he was crushed by a wave in Hawaii. And Paul Bragg put Mr. Irons on fasting, cleansing, and detoxification programs and cured him.
Wow.
Led to Mr. Irons, you know, second career. And then he realized that he wanted to get involved making products. So he actually made the first green food wheatgrass, barleygrass, ryegrass concentrate in the market called Green Life or Spring Green. He sold his products to both health distributors, stores, and doctors under different names.
Hmm.
And he also was the sole importer of psyllium seed in the United States. Well, everybody knows what psyllium seed is because it's in Metamucil.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great fiber. It's a legume fiber that has real wonderful qualities. It holds moisture, and it gets into the gut and bowel, and it cleans out pockets. It's just a great fiber. In fact, at one time, Mr. Irons was the sole importer of psyllium seed in the United States. In 1959, the FDA took him to court for making health claims about fiber. Now, every claim was true, but that doesn't matter because the law says that you can't make health claims about a food. Funny how the drug comes... funny how the drug companies work that into the political process, but
yeah,
that's
exactly
the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
They convicted him on 6 misdemeanors and sentenced him to a year in jail, and he actually had 6 months in a federal penitentiary and was released on good behavior.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, Mr. Irons was, like, the most dynamic guy, and he was, you know, I pestered him. And so, anyway, he put me on his 7-day cleansing program, which is a modified fast cleansing program. So for 7 days, you don't eat anything, but you do take his green life, and you take wheat germ oil and take flax oil and vitamin C, and you do that 5 times a day. And then in between the meals, so to speak, or the nutrient, you drink his cleansing drink, which consisted of the psyllium seed and bentonite. Bentonite is a liquid clay. Another fascinating story, Mr. Irons was really intrigued by the Maasai people in Africa. Do you know the Maasai? Have you heard of them?
Yes, I've met some. I was there for a while.
Okay, well, you know, they take a dirty old arrow and they cut the jugular vein of their cattle and they take off a couple liters of blood that just squirts out of the jugular, and then they take this mud and they slap it on the neck, which stops the bleeding and disinfects the cut.
Wow. And then they drink the blood, don't they?
Yeah, they drink the blood. They mix it with raw milk, and they curdle it and ferment it and whatever they do. But their diet consists primarily of raw blood and raw milk.
Wow.
And they're fabulously healthy people, you know. And they don't kill their cows. They don't eat the meat. You know, that way you can, you know, a cow can support you for a long time on milk and meat, if you think about
it. And they're beautiful. They're tall and strong and usually quite handsome.
Exactly. They're remarkable. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Irons, being the pioneer he is, he wanted to know, what is that stuff? So he actually went to Africa and got a sample of the mud from the Maasai's.
Wow.
And brought it back, and a friend of his from MIT, because Mr. Irons is from Boston, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, they went into the lab and they analyzed, and it was just bentonite clay. It's just one of the most common clays in the world. And so Irons comes up with all these ideas, like purifying it so it's USP pharmaceutical quality, and then putting it in colloidal suspension so you can drink it and get it into your intestinal tract, which is a remarkable remedy for the gut. And then made it into pastes and salves so that you could apply topically. And to this day, the products are unchanged from his original formula, and they are absolutely fabulous. Bentonite is amazing, and the clays that he made were just as amazing as the liquid that you drink for intestinal. So on this program, you know, I would take the psyllium seed and mix it with bentonite clay water and mix it in some, a little bit of juice and water, shake it up and drink it 5 times a day. We called it the Roto-Rooter. And then every day you got to do an enema or a colonic. Well, the first time I wouldn't do the enemas. I was 22 years old and I just wasn't there. And I did okay, but I only went 5 days, and I broke the fast, and I kind of psyched myself out, and I was really disappointed because it was so anticlimactic to do so. So he had me do this, the change of every season, 4 times a year. So this was June, so on September 21st, I did it again. But this time, I was absolutely determined to go the whole 7 days, but on the 4th day, I started getting so toxic and so sick and headaches, and I was completely miserable. I couldn't even work. And then, and only then, I read the instructions on how to do the enema, the home enema, which didn't, you know, I had had an experience in a hospital when I was having foot surgery with a nurse that tried to give me an enema, which was a disaster. You may not remember, I don't know if you ever had a hospitalization in the 60s or 70s, but enemas were routinely administered before surgery.
Yes, I do remember. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this nurse didn't know what she was doing, and I didn't know what she was doing, and it was a disaster. So that was my idea of an enema. But when I read Mr. Irons' instructions, it was like, oh, I get this. I can do this. I'll lay on my left side because, you know, the rectum goes up and tips to the left into the sigmoid on the left. So if you lay on your left, you're working with gravity. And then, you know, you take a little water at a time, like a cup at a time, half a cup. Don't just open up the valve and expect 2 quarts of water, you know, to fill up the colon. So I followed directions. I mean, I was so sick. And I knew if I called Mr. Irons, the first thing he was going to say is, well, what are you getting out on your enemas? Because getting the debris out of the colon was his whole thing.
Right.
And, you know, that whole theme of gut health was heavily emphasized by the naturopaths of yesteryear. I mean, heavily. Mm-hmm. And now it's all coming to, you know, coming home to roost because we're discovering so many things that gut health affects. Hearts. You know, the heart is affected dramatically by the health of the intestinal tract. The immune system. Antibodies are produced in the gut.
Your emotions, your mental health.
Yeah, you know, 80% of our dopamine and serotonin and neurohormones and neurotransmitters all made in the gut. So the old timers were onto this. They didn't have the science to back them up, but they knew they were onto it. And I never got another boil from the time I did my first cleansing program.
Oh, wow, really?
Right.
Hey, I want to interrupt you for a sec because Dr. Oz is on the front page of a newspaper, of a magazine right now talking about gut health.
Good.
Today.
Good.
So I'm like, wow, that's great.
Well, he should be, and so should all the scientists. And the gastroenterologists out there who have been kind of asleep at the trigger here, they should wake up and realize that what they're dealing with is really the foundation of the health of the body. You have to have a healthy gut.
Right.
And the second time I did the cleanse, I did the enema, and we're backtracking to how I got into this field. And I only took about half. It was a 2-quart hot water, you know, enema douche hot water combination bag. You know, the old bags that everybody fears to look at.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh my God, what is that? And I followed the instructions. I only had a little water in at a time. I massaged. I changed positions. I dispersed the water. I put my feet up in the air and twisted and moved it and let a little more water in and did the same thing. You know, massage, disperse, change positions, let a little more water in. And I took about half of that bag, and I was in shock. But then the pressure was so great that I had to let the waste out. And the waste came out of me that was like unbelievable. I'm talking mucus ropes and fecal stones and the debris, which was shocking. And
wow,
I was 22
really?
Years old. I didn't have a clue, but I knew I was in a state of shock. And I call it the epiphany on the toilet bowl. That's when I decided that this is what I was going to do for a career, because I was so motivated, and my experience on the cleanse was so powerful. And I hadn't had a boil in 3 months for my first cleanse. And I knew I was on the right track. And so then I went back and finished the remaining half of the bag and had more debris come out. It was like I was shocked. And another thing that happened to me on the toilet bowl was I never even heard of acupuncture at the time. In 1972, nobody really did. I mean, Nixon just opened up China, right? I mean, it was sort of like coming to the fore. But I started getting these tingling feelings in my ankles while this waste and removal process was going on. And then this energy moved up my legs and pulsed through my body and came out my hands. I swear. I know that sounds like a completely, you know, fantastical.
No, not in my world. It doesn't.
Yeah. And I was pulsing with this energy that I knew was healthy and vital and wonderful. And that's when I decided, you know, I really wanted to do this. And I had this amazing man in my life, Mr. Irons, who was willing to, you know, tutor people and take people on. And then I started working for him in 1975. I did the National Health Federation shows, the big health shows, alternative health shows in Chicago and Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., and really worked with Mr. Irons for 10 years. And then my wife was getting her master's degree. My wife, Karen, was getting her master's degree in nutritional science from the University of Wisconsin. But Karen jokes that, you know, the thing she learned most about nutrition at the university level was that it wasn't very important.
Yeah, that's probably true, eh?
I mean, really, because, you know, it was so downplayed. I mean, you got better nutritional information if you were studying to be a vet, because vets knew that you had to have good nutrition for your animals, you know, your farm animals, your whatever, your house pets, et cetera. But none of this was applied to human beings. It was like, it doesn't matter what you eat, et cetera, et cetera. But Karen's dad was inspired by Adele Davis. You probably know the name.
Oh,
many
yes.
of your listeners probably do.
Yep. And the Bible. We read her Bibles, a lot of us.
And so Karen was also inspired by Adele Davis through her father, and she got a master's in nutritional science and became a registered dietitian and taught at the university for a year and a half. But that was very frustrating because they insisted that she teach that sugar was as good a carbohydrate as a fruit or a vegetable, and
wow.
fiber is inconsequential to health, and all supplementation is quackery. Those are things that were really she was required to teach, and she wouldn't do it. And so she left her job, and then we opened up a clinic, and we called it Holistic Services because that's what we were really interested in. We spelled holistic with a W because we never thought it would be misspelled, right?
Yep.
So now here it is. It's misspelled, except when I type it. I always type it holistic with a W. But
I don't think of it as misspelled because I think of hologram and that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, then I'll have to adjust my thinking accordingly. Now, I never thought of the hologram, but I always thought of it in different ways. But okay.
All but right, it is the migration of that word. It has moved through some big changes since the 60s, 70s.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So then we opened up our office. We just, you know, said, let's try it. And people were like, oh, you can't do this in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you know. But actually, I was on the first board of directors at a co-op in Milwaukee called Outpost Natural Food Co-op, which is just as big as community co-op here in Bellingham now. And I knew that Milwaukee had a community that might just support an alternative kind of a health service. And Karen's credentials were very valuable at the time. I didn't have any credentials in nutrition. It was just a matter of wanting to do it. And what we did, we put everybody on cleansing programs. We put everybody on the VEIMS program. And our practice grew, like, right away.
Wow. And people really noticed a huge change, huh?
Exactly. You can't do the seven-day cleansing program and not notice a huge change. I mean, it's a powerful program. So if you go to veirons.com, irons is plural, I-R-O-N-S, no periods, no underscores, just V, Victor Earl Irons, but just veirons.com. Click on cleansing programs, click on seven-day, and you'll see the whole outline. Mm-hmm. It's dramatic. And Karen developed a little specialty in fertility therapy, and she found out when she took couples that were having trouble conceiving and then put them on a cleansing program, they conceived.
Well, that makes sense.
And this is what cured Mr. Irons of his ankylosing spondylitis. So we realized, you know, and then we saw amazing things happen on these cleansing programs. And then a salesman, our standard process salesman, came in and said, you guys need a doctor here, you know. And he hooked us up with a physician in Madison, Wisconsin, who came to our office a couple times a week and would see our people, and he would prove all of our work for insurance coverage. Because Karen, being an RD, you know, if she gets a referral from a doctor, you know, insurance would cover it, at least in those days. Mm. And so we started to hire physicians, and one of our doctors developed an IV clinic, so we were doing chelation and intravenous nutritional therapy and things. And then we started studying with Jonathan Wright and Jeffrey Bland and all these wonderful teachers that are remarkable. And to this day, you know, Jonathan Wright, in my estimation, who's an MD in Seattle, is the number one medical doctor in the field as far as, you know, who he's taught. And he's so innovative and he's so creative and literally a bit of a genius when it comes to plugging nutrients into body chemistry and shifting diseases, improving conditions. Jonathan Wright is remarkable. Jeffrey Bland, we started studying with him in the late 70s and early 80s, and there's probably not a practitioner in this field who hasn't been directly or indirectly taught by Jeffrey Bland. Mm. We stumbled into the very first seminar he ever taught because our salesman in Milwaukee, who was a Nutrinine salesman at the time, introduced us to him and said, come to the seminar. So we said, sure, we'll drive down there and go to the seminar. And lo and behold, it was Jeffrey Bland. But little did we know then. And he's from Puget Sound. He's in Seattle, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something about the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, there really is.
Well, tell me something. When you're talking about all these guys, they're doing, of course, innovative research and so on. But they have to have some, and you also, and Karen, have to have some standard testing that you use with your people, right?
Yes, and that came later on in our practice as we developed expertise, primarily from learning from our doctors and from our teachers, like Bland and Dr. Wright, et cetera, and many others, Dr. Gaby, and, I mean, literally dozens of others, Bernard Jensen, it goes on and on.
Oh, wow, Jensen, too.
Oh, and John Christopher, Dr. Mm-hmm. Christopher was the king of herbology in those days.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a heyday for the crossroads between the former naturopathic community, the old-timers, I like to call them, and the whole new wave that we're in to right now. Mm-hmm. That was the transition, really, in the 70s.
But didn't you get into legal problems?
Well, we did. I'll get to that in just a second. But so from our teachers, we learned how to work with blood chemistry and hair analysis and hormone testing and saliva testing and stool chemistries. And then we started to apply that and, you know, set up accounts with the labs that specialize in these areas. And so, then we became more specialized as far as you know, getting into specific conditions and discovering certain things about a person's chemistry, like high lead or mercury or cadmium or, you know, staph or strep or pseudomonas or proteus or any of the, you know, infectious organisms and parasites. We did thousands of stool tests from 1985 when we started doing stool testing to 1995. We had a clinic that was really focused on stool tests because so many of our chronically ill people had parasites. It was remarkable. Mm-hmm. And the only change that occurred there was Dr. Dow, who was doing our stool tests. She was the United States Army's parasitologist for 30 years and had a private practice on the side. She retired, and that's what shifted everything. But Dow was such a capable parasitologist. And she found parasites in sick people that nobody else found.
Wow.
And so those were breakthrough kind of things for us. And getting on to the legal comment that you mentioned, or the question you asked, In 1980, my wife was taken to court for practicing medicine without a license. It was really our clinic, but it was Karen was the focal point of a TV investigation into our clinic. And what happened was, we've been practicing for 4 years then, was they ran a plant through our office and then came out and did an interview with us under the guise that it was going to be a promotional interview. But they kind of turned the corner, they turned the tables on Karen and said, you know, they turned it into a 60-minute kind of like investigative reporting thing.
Oh, wow.
And they aired it on the local news, and our business boomed.
Oh, this is great.
Phone rang off the hook. It was amazing. I mean, I remember one day I made 30 appointments and I canceled two.
Wow.
It was like, there's no such thing as bad publicity. I guess that's the old adage, right?
That's the old adage, all right, yeah. Isn't that weird? It's wonderful.
Yeah, and then the private investigators start snooping around, and they wanted the Milwaukee County Medical Society, which is just a group of private group of docs who buy malpractice insurance. It sounds like a government agency, but it's not. Just like the Federal Reserve doesn't have, it's not federal and doesn't have any reserves. But that's the name of it, right? The Federal Reserve, no money, no government, but we call it the Federal Reserve. So what happened with the legal thing is we were in depositions, everybody's under oath, and they start coming up with Exhibit A, Exhibit B, Exhibit C, which is like hair analysis interpretation guides, blood chemistry interpretation guides, hormone interpretation guides, things that to us were highly sensitive, you know, really sensitive. Mm-hmm. So I asked the person, I asked the court examiner who had the power of subpoena, if I could ask questions. Oh, everybody was there. He says, sure, everybody's under oath. They're all sworn in. He said, you can ask any question you want. We're in discovery. And I said, well, I looked at the private investigators for the Milwaukee County Medical Society. I said, well, where did you get Exhibit A? Where did you get Exhibit B? Where did you get Exhibit C? And they lied. They said they got it from the plant that the TV station ran through our office. And I said to Karen, did you give her that information? She goes, no way. No way. I mean, I met her once, you know. This is really sensitive information, and we're trying to figure out where are they coming up with this. It's a long story that I won't get into too many of the details, but what the long and the short is that there was a doctor who had a mutual patient with Karen.
Oh.
And was a real success story. I mean, Karen had a wonderful success with this woman who had one lung and had an impaired, you know, respiratory condition. And she was always curious about, her doctor was always curious about what Karen was doing, and she was asking Karen for information in a good heart, you know, with the right spirit. And Karen was providing it to her, and she was showing it to her doctor, who was making copies of it, and it turned out that he was releasing this information without her permission, breaching her confidentiality, and they were lying under oath, perjuring themselves, which is a felony, to cover his butt.
Wow.
If I can put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
after we've had big descriptions of enemas, I think we can handle that.
And that's actually, and when we found this out and contacted the woman, she signed an affidavit happily indicating that she never gave anybody permission to release her medical records and that she was offended by the fact that her doctor would do this. And they all ran to retract their statements, and the examiner was livid. I mean, he was really upset, and he threw it out on grounds of prejudice and conspiracy against the plaintiffs. So that's what happened in 1980. I'm 30 years old, and, you know, my wife is pregnant with our first child, and it's like, wow, these people will commit a felony to try to get us on a misdemeanor. Practicing medicine without a license in Wisconsin is a misdemeanor.
Hmm.
So anyway, and
but there was a lot of talk back in the 70s and 80s about quackery and the dangers of this kind of work. Actually, that's gone on for many, many years, hasn't it?
Sure, it has. It has. Mm-hmm. And the old timers who were put in jail, you know, like Mr. Irons and others.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They really dealt with the brunt of it and persevered. That nothing deterred Mr. Irons. I mean, he had no animosity. He was the kindest, most gentle, generous man I've ever met, and what he used to like to do at the conventions on his name tag, which would say V.E. Irons, he'd write underneath it, the jailbird.
What a character.
Yeah, this was a badge of honor for those guys who actually paid those dues, you know, to allow for this industry to become what it's become.
Who really knew what it was. But let's go to this part, which is that there are trends in health. There's some tremendous trends in health, some of which are really awful. But it seems fascinating to me that those are going kind of parallel to the evolution of this consciousness of nutrition and how the body works and what we can do about it. don't you think? Like diabetes or
osteoporosis.
I heard you speak on bone density the other night, or bone health, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even the osteoporosis, you said, has kind of launched itself since the 50s.
Yeah, I gave the statistic on how much osteoporosis has increased since the 1950s, and it's truly staggering, truly staggering. And I didn't tell the story about the church in England. They were moving an old, ancient church, you know, in England. I don't know about ancient, but really old church in England. And in the basement, they found they buried people down there, say, all these bones, corpses. You know, it was a burial site underneath the church.
Mm.
And they measured the bone density of these dead folks, and they were incredible. These people had incredible bone density.
Wow.
But they were working out in the fields. They were, you know, they were on the land. They were on their feet. And as we talked about in class, in the bone density class or the bone health class, there's nothing like weight-bearing exercise to enhance bone density. Nothing.
But that isn't the only thing. Didn't you think that it was being interrupted, the density of the bones being interrupted by the deterioration of what? Strength and health or pharmaceuticals or...
Well, I think everything, in the sense that the whole lifestyle has changed. I mean, I was born in 1950, and when I think back of my childhood, I mean, we were outdoors all the time.
Yes, we were too.
I mean, and barefoot in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember when summer hit, you know, I'd go out to my grandparents' cottage outside of Milwaukee on the lake, and we'd be running barefoot. Ooh, 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 you know, we'd be hurting our feet in a week or so, and, you know, we'd be running over those rocks like they didn't even exist, you know?
I know. I remember that.
It was an outdoor lifestyle, and, mm-hmm. and the food is so different now. So we have a life that's much more passive, much less physical vigor and activity. I mean, whatever happened to the family farm? I mean, you know, we just don't have anywhere near the lifestyle that we had when people were generally healthier.
Mm-hmm.
I realize people are living longer now, but when I look at the quality of life, I mean, I've been in and out of a lot of assisted living homes. My mother-in-law passed away recently at 95, and I'm thinking, gosh, I just don't know, you know, if I really want to be kept alive on meds and just kind of vegetate. There's a lot of life expectancy statistics are skewed in that way, I think.
I think you're right. So let's jump into things like diabetes or candida. Can we drop into some of the health problems that are a sign of our times?
Well, sure. And I think we'll see a lot of common denominators here between osteoporosis and diabetes and candida or candida and kidney problems, like, which are becoming rampant in the United States, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of common denominators, a lot of junk food, 170 pounds per person of sugar. I heard 177. I read another statistic recently, 155. You know, I don't really know if it's 150 or 170. But
is that per year or what? How long?
Pardon?
How long?
Per year.
Per year, okay.
Per capita consumption per year.
Mm-hmm.
10 years ago, the per capita consumption of soda pop in the United States was 45 gallons per capita. Now you think, 45 gallons, how could that be? Well, one 12-ounce can a day is 34 gallons a year.
Wow.
Just pull out your calculator. It's really obvious.
So then when you get those super drinks, I mean, that really adds up, doesn't it?
And when we were kids, they were 7-ounce sodas, remember?
Yeah.
Then when 12, we thought, wow, 12 ounces, you know, when I could rarely ever have one because it was regulated like a drug almost, you know, as far as my family was, oh, you can't have a soda now. Oh, no, no, no.
Same with mine. We hardly ever had sugar, you know.
I mean, it was so different that way.
It was the Saturday movies that we got to have something.
And then even chemicals and all the stuff that's put in food. And one of the things that Karen kind of was dealing with at the universities is, she had to teach that food chemicals are all tested and they're all safe and everything. But one of the points that she pointed out to me in the midst of that time back then was that, yeah, these chemicals may have been tested individually, but they're never tested collectively, and people don't eat one food chemical at a time. They might need half a dozen or a dozen at a time.
Right.
And who knows about the interaction of all these different food chemicals? I mean, they're never studied. So we've changed everything. And then you look at the corn syrup and the high fructose corn syrup that's on the market now. And I remember reading an article a couple years ago from the University of Minnesota School of Nutrition. And they were taking laboratory animals and feeding them high levels of high fructose corn syrup and inducing type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
And
how much diabetes is there these days? It's incredibly high, isn't it?
It's an epidemic. The mm-hmm. type 2 diabetes is an epidemic. Now, along with that, you have the political pressure that comes to bear on testing standards, where, for example, the range for glucose if you go back to the 60s and 70s and 80s and well into the 90s, the standard range for fasting glucose was 70 to 110. That was it. It was that way all along. Well, now the range is 70 to 99. So you squeeze that range and you make more diagnoses. It's just like with the cholesterol thing, you know.
Yeah, I want to talk about cholesterol. What's the truth on that?
Well, cholesterol is a vitally important raw material. We make all of our steroid hormones from it, first of all. That's why it's a sterol, cholesterol. It's a sterol from which steroid hormones are made. So that's number one, is we make all of our steroids. And steroid hormones are power brokers, and every one of them is synthesized from cholesterol. So it's vitally important. Now, another thing about cholesterol is that it's extremely important in the health of the cell membrane or the cell wall. A cell membrane should be at least 50% cholesterol. And if it's not, the cell membrane doesn't function properly, and it's more prone towards cancer. Now, when we used to do testing way back in the 80s, and it was unusual to do high-density cholesterols, but we learned about that from Jeffrey Bland, so we were making special requests to laboratories for certain types of tests. And because it was unusual, the lab would provide these big printouts that came along with the test results, and they would say, you know, statistical analysis indicates that high cholesterols are associated with increased risk of heart disease, and low cholesterols are associated with increased risk of cancer. That's what we actually saw from labs in the 70s and the early 80s, and you never hear that anymore as far as the risk of low cholesterol, which is very legit because every cell membrane in the body has to have cholesterol in the cell membrane in order to be healthy and functional. So that's what cholesterol does.
So the interpretation was what was wrong, is that right?
Pardon?
So the interpretation of what it meant, that's what was wrong, or that's where we were misled, is it?
Well, I don't know that I would call it the interpretation because, you know, you mean as far as low cholesterol goes?
No, yeah, as far as them saying that this the high one is heart and the low one is cancer.
Increased risks in both directions, yeah. And what happened is the low cholesterol statistics kind of just went by the wayside because, you know, the drug company saw an enormous opportunity here of lowering cholesterol and then, of course, eventually came up with drugs to do that. And now, I mean, this is the most profitable drug that's ever been marketed, I think, have been statin drugs. And they do lower cholesterol, but they do it by altering the liver in a way which is not at all desirable. And ironically, depletes CoQ10, which is an essential enzyme throughout the body, and is concentrated in the heart. And so when you're taking a drug to lower the cholesterol to supposedly reduce heart disease, but yet at the same time you're eliminating a nutrient that the heart requires, it's sort of you know, an inconsistency that is hard to justify.
That's pretty interesting, isn't it? So how does a person figure that out? Like, what if you want to avoid strokes? What if you don't want to have strokes? How do you prevent that?
Well, of course, nobody wants to have a stroke.
It's a big deal these days. It's kind of in fashion for a lot of people.
Gosh, it's so common. Yeah, I mean, heart disease is still the number one killer. Cardiovascular disease, I should say, is the number one killer in the United States, and stroke. And, you know, there's really not much difference between a stroke and a heart attack. It's just where the clot forms. I mean, if the clot forms in the coronary artery, it's a heart attack. If it forms in the carotid artery, it's a stroke. So it's the same chemistry, though. And so... and certainly, if the arteries are plaqued, if there's a lot of plaque in the arteries, I'm not saying that cholesterol is a non-issue, but I am saying that it's not the cause of the plaque. Plaque is overwhelmingly calcium. It's 90% calcium plaque. And what lays down plaque in the arteries is bacteria, just like bacteria lay down plaque in the mouth. In fact, the Swedes have isolated the bacteria associated with heart disease. There's a book on it called The Calcium Bomb, as in B-O-M-B. I don't particularly like the name, but it's a weekend read. It's written for the layperson, and it will explain to you the real cause of heart disease is a bacterial infection in the arteries, which is laying down plaque, just like bacteria lay down plaque in the mouth. And that's why if you have a lot of plaque in your mouth, if you have a lot of periodontal bacterial issues in your mouth, you're like at least double the risk of heart disease or cardiovascular disease.
So what is it that's out of control that lays down extra plaque?
It's the bacteria. And they call it a nanobacteria in the Swedish report. But it's a microscopic, you know, bacteria in the arteries that is actually infecting the arteries. And, you know,
is it something that you're born with? Is it something that's in your natural biochemistry, a lineage thing, or what?
Nobody knows, but I would think that there really is the likelihood that it comes through the family bloodline.
Well, I want to ask you this, is that I have too much bacteria for my teeth. They've come in rotten. And my dad had that. My aunt had that. And it's not about sugar. It's not about not cleaning your teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering about people like who have that, like me and other people.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of the same thing, or do you know that?
I don't know. But I can introduce you to a laboratory, a dental lab that tests saliva for the bacteria and isolates the bacteria very specifically and also tells you what your treatment options are.
And do they relate it to the heart bacteria as well?
They don't, no. This is independent of that because the theory of heart disease that it's caused by bacteria that lay down the plaque is not remotely endorsed by the medical community at this time. Although I had a conversation with a cardiologist at Mayo.
Sounds like it's an ad for it, doesn't it?
Exactly. I had a conversation with a cardiologist at Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, and I asked him about it, and he said that he had definitely heard about it, and he thought that it was like, you know, it was going to be the future. But right now, the economics are so entrenched, and there's so much money involved in treating heart disease the way we do, that it's not going to change anytime soon. Something dramatic is going to have to change.
Well, if those of us who are running alongside of the whole system and learning to break through, how would you recommend people deal with the bacterial count in their body, mind, nutritionally or alternatively?
Well, first of all, you don't want to feed the bacteria with a lot of sugar and junk and things that you really shouldn't be eating anyway, which most of us can figure out, you know. you want to pull the rug out from underneath. The support of the organisms, just like you mentioned candida, you know, you'll never get rid of candida if you're feeding it. You have to starve it out. And the way you starve out candida is with a low-carb diet because, yeast is a very simple organism. It basically consumes carbohydrate, which would be sugar, whatever, and produces alcohol and carbon dioxide. That's it. I mean, it doesn't have a very sophisticated life cycle, so if you starve it of carbohydrates, you're really going to weaken it, and then you can eradicate it much more easily. And the same thing goes with this bacteria throughout the body, whether it's this particular bacteria, the nanobacteria that's associated with heart disease, or whether it's staph or strep or pseudomonas or any of the bacteria that can get into the body. You want to have a really good, high-quality diet that is devoid of junk food and sugars and soda pop and all the stuff that has become standard fare in the United States.
So that's like protein and veggies.
Yeah, that would be the focal point. You should always build your diet around vegetables. I mean, to me, the diet should be 70% vegetables.
Okay.
And you put some whole fruits in there and adequate protein, and take it and leave it alone. I mean, I don't personally eat hardly any grains. I mean, once in a while I'll have brown rice, sometimes some millet or something, but that's pretty much it. Mm-hmm. But then there are natural remedies that you can use that are appearing to be effective against this bacteria. One is Uva ursi, which is an herb. It's an anti-infective herb that's typically used for bladder infections and very effective, I might add, for that purpose.
And water retention, too, I think.
Yeah, it's a kidney kind of support, kidney-bladder type of an herb, but it's an antimicrobial.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm finding extremely useful is the Pharmax garlic freeze-dried, and that's exactly how it's labeled. Pharmax, spelled Pharmax. Pharmax garlic freeze-dried. You can get it all over the Internet, Amazon. You know, it's all over the Internet.
Okay.
And it's a very powerful garlic, so powerful that if you don't eat it with food or take it with food, you'll be sorry.
So if it's Pharmax pH, that means it's a pharmaceutical?
Well, it doesn't mean it's a pharm. No, it's not a prescription item. It's just a very potent garlic imported from England. And it's strongest garlic I've ever used, by far. I mean, it makes kyolic garlic look like child's play.
Wow.
And kyolic garlic doesn't have a good, you know, function as a nutrient, but as an anti-infective, as an antimicrobial, you need a more potent garlic.
Well, that's excellent because garlic, I mean, that's really good for the intestinal tract, too, and for the flora, intestinal flora, isn't it?
Yeah. It's good, you know, it's basically good for everything. Now, there are people, some people can't handle it, you know, and there are some people who are allergic to it or whatever, but they're few and far between. My experience with Pharmax has been it's been extremely well tolerated, much better than I would have anticipated, and I don't even pick up a smell from it. Some people do, but it depends on, you know, your priorities. But there are, and another one is oregano. So when you work with those herbs, you can definitely reduce the bacterial activity that's involved in the formation of plaque in the arteries. And I want to mention something, too, for any of the medical listeners out there. You know, it's interesting when you look at the medical model of how cholesterol causes plaque. And what they're basically saying is that LDL, or low-density cholesterol, has to be oxidized. That's like when a fat goes rancid, that's oxidation. We've all tasted rancid oils. They burn. Oh, yeah. They're nasty in your throat. So when fats interact with oxygen, they go rancid, and it's called oxidation. So the LDL has to be oxidized first before it can become plaque. And then the medical people say, and then macrophages appear. Well, macrophages are like the strongest anti-infective of all the white blood cells that the immune system secretes. And so they're assuming that the oxidized LDL is what's attracting the macrophages. But what's really attracting the macrophages is the bacteria. And that is it's perfectly in line with medical philosophy. Bacteria, infectious bacteria, attract white blood cells to digest them, macrophages. Not LDL oxidized fat. That doesn't attract macrophages. So the actual medical model that's being, you know, offered as an explanation for the cause of plaque actually is perfectly describing the appearance of the bacteria.
Huh. And the bacteria comes from that imbalance, does it? I mean, it's opportunistic.
Where it's coming from. Is it in the bloodline? Is it passed from the mother's gut, you know, to the child, you know, in the birth canal or whatever? We don't really know exactly the origin of the bacteria, but there's no question that it's involved in the formation of plaque, and the Swedes have proved it. And again, in the calcium bomb, you can read the whole story. It will eventually be accepted here, and it will revolutionize, because the way you would treat heart disease and the way they recommend in the calcium bomb is you use EDTA, which is a chelator, to remove, they call it remove the roof of the plaque. Because, see, these bacteria, the reason they lay down plaque is because they're living in the plaque, is they're making their own sandcastles. And they live in there, and you remove the roof with EDTA, and then you come in with an antibiotic and kill it. You know, it's a medical text. I mean, it's a medical commentary. I would rather use garlic or oregano or uversi or something of that.
But those work, right? I mean, they are really good, huh?
Yeah, those herbs are exceptional anti-infectives, antimicrobials. Absolutely, I think the three best on the market. There are others, of course, too.
Like, what about olive leaf?
Olive leaf is wonderful. It's a great product. And another little twist about olive leaf, it's one of the best natural remedies for blood pressure. You know, historically, I think most clinicians who've been around for a while would agree that the two toughest areas to work with, to get consistent results using natural remedies, have been insomnia and blood pressure. Hmm. So, and the insomnia one is still hardly solved.
And that's one of my bugaboos.
Blood pressure was always challenging. Naturally, and it's been challenging medically too. I mean, there's literally half a dozen different, you know, types of blood pressure meds on the market because sometimes you have to go through quite a process to find out what works for the patient.
Right.
But Terry Lemerant, who's an old friend from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who developed enzymatic therapy, which was a huge hit in the health food stores years ago, has imported this olive leaf from Europe, and he sells it under the name Blood Pressure Health. By Terry Naturally, Blood Pressure Health by Terry Naturally. And like so many things, I learned about it from a local client here who I was working with, who had blood pressure problems. We were trying different things. And she heard Terry speak when he spoke at the co-op a couple years ago. And she tried his remedy, and it helped her tremendously. Hmm. So and that's the nature of this field. If you're not open to learning from the people you're working with, you're going to miss huge opportunities, because nobody can keep track of everything that's going on out there.
Well, it's always intriguing to me that they laugh scientifically. They laugh at testimonials. But it seems to me that the human variable is so difficult to categorize and to quantify that you have to listen for testimonials.
I agree. And testimonials are called anecdotes, and it's usually a put down, you know?
Yeah, I know. That's
I think it was Dr. Gaby who taught me that, you know, there are good anecdotes and there are bad anecdotes. So you got to sort it out. And, you know, the trial and error. And so in the last couple year or so, I've been using Blood Pressure Health, which is an olive leaf extract. That's what got me onto this subject. Your question about that, which is great for the immune system, as you pointed out. Is this particular version from Europe is remarkably effective at lowering blood pressure, and even at just 1, 2, 3 caps a day. So it's in fact, Terry was having a hard time getting in. He ran short on his supply, and it was off the market for a month or so. I mean, I had people panicking without their product, and then finally got it back and got it in from Europe again, and it's. You know, olive leaf extract, there's so many wonderful things you can do with herbs and natural remedies and vitamins and minerals and things of that nature. It's really unlimited, and it's always growing and, kind of like revealing itself.
I get really excited about it. I wanted to ask you about the cleanses, the full 7-day cleanse. Are there ways of people just applying changes to their diet that can actually cleanse it over time? You know what I mean?
Oh, of course. Sure. I mean, if just eating a high percentage of vegetables will provide a cleansing effect and an alkalizing effect, because one of the consequences of our lifestyle, the American lifestyle and the Western lifestyle, is high acid intake. So we eat a diet and we consume about 80% of everything we consume forms an acid ash in the body. Now, an acid ash, the bottom line is what effect it has on the blood. Say, for example, grapefruit. Well, obviously, grapefruit is citric acid. Mm-hmm. It's acidic. But when you eat it, it donates alkaline minerals to the blood, and so it has an alkaline effect. So who would think that grapefruit or you know, would have an alkalizing effect on the blood?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the
And lemon as well, doesn't it?
It does. Grapefruit does have an alkalizing effect on the blood, even though it's citric acid, because it donates alkaline minerals to the blood. So when you donate alkaline minerals to the blood, you have an alkalizing effect. And the blood must be alkaline. If the blood goes acidic, it's fatal. Alkaline blood, you know, 7 is neutral on the pH scale. Blood is what, 7.2, 7.3, 7.4. It's in that ballpark. You can't have acid blood. And the body has so many checks and balances built into it to maintain the homeostasis or the stable sameness of the alkaline nature of the blood that it will not allow the blood. It will rob calcium from the bones, and this we talked about in our osteoporosis class last week. The body, the parathyroid gland, has the ability to secrete a hormone called parathormone, which will actually pull calcium out of the bones and put it in the blood, because blood calcium is much, much, much more important than bone calcium, because blood calcium has many functions. It transports, it alkalizes, it does many things, and the body will pull that calcium out of the bones to buffer the acidity coming in from the diet, you know, of too much sugar and too much white flour products and too much meat and proteins, and I mean, and then washing it down with Coca-Cola or soda pop or coffee, you know, tannic acid.
So even though it pulls the calcium from the bones themselves are getting thinned out then, aren't they?
Exactly. That is actually the underlying chemistry of osteoporosis. Osteoporosis has nothing to do with calcium deficiency, not in this country. In the United States and Scandinavia and Europe, you know, that's 1, 2, 3 in calcium consumption in the world. And we're the country that has the most osteoporosis and osteoarthritis.
Wow. Isn't that intriguing?
Yeah, it really is. And Jeffrey Bland taught us this back in the 80s, you know, about what's really going on with osteoporosis is this this acid lifestyle, this tremendous consumption of acid ash foods and substances, including alcohol, which is acid ash, that's depleting the body, depleting the bones of calcium, because the blood needs the calcium to buffer the acidity.
I think that's really helpful information.
It is. So you have to change your lifestyle, your diet. I mean, no supplementation. I mean, to me, you could, even with a Uwe Ersi or garlic or whatever, I mean, if you're continuing to live the lifestyle that caused the problem in the first place, you're not going to patch it up, you know, with herbs or vitamins or minerals or drugs for that matter, because mm-hmm. the underlying condition is still intact. And eventually it expresses itself. I mean, you can only hold it at bay for a while unless you completely revamp your lifestyle, which is what I'm recommending. Mm-hmm. You know, how you think, first of all, because thoughts are powerful. And when we energize them with belief, I mean, it's a very, very powerful thing. So where's our mental attitude at? What's our state of mind? What's our state of thinking? How aware am I day in and day out, moment to moment? How aware am I of what my thinking is?
Mm-hmm.
And where is it going? Is it creative? Is it uplifting? Is it loving? Is it encompassing? Or is it down and depressed and distressed and fearful and, you know, guilty or whatever? You know, I mean, thinking is so powerful.
I want to talk to you again soon, because I would really like you to get into mental health and nutrition. And you're talking about thinking, and I'm going, that would be let's do a whole show on mental health and thinking and belief and all that. Can we do that soon?
Yeah, that would be fun, sure. And there's a lot to work with there. But that's really what sets the stage for a change in your lifestyle. That's what motivates a person to say, I'm going to do this differently. I'm not going to eat any sugar. I'm not going to eat any corn syrup. I'm not going to eat wheat. I'm going to drop dairy products, you know, or whatever is right for you. And that can be individual. But to make a commitment and really hold to it and adhere to the you know, for the long haul and really see the changes that result, it's very rewarding.
So how do we start? Do we start with a hair analysis test, or is it essential that we do that, or can we start more simply than that?
Oh, sure. You can just start with your own thoughts and say, these are the changes I'm going to make. I mean, that has to be the starting point. That's more important than a blood test or hair analysis or hormone profile or a stool test, is coming to a decision, realizing that in every moment we're always choosing, you know, one or the other. I'm going to eat this or I'm not, you know. It's like it comes down to that personal inner motivation that we establish through our own thinking process and our emotional state. And, of course, food is so emotional, too. I mean, when you think about it, the first thing a baby does is breathe, and the second thing a baby does is eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a deeply ingrained experience that has a lot of energy and emotion and, you know, tied into it. But it can be changed, and if it's up to me to make the change, because it's another nice thing I like about the alternative health field is that it requires that the patient or the participant make the change. Mm-hmm. Nobody can do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to a doctor, and he can give you a drug or she can give you a drug or whatever, and it may help in this way or that way. It may have side effects and consequences that you don't like, et cetera. But you didn't have to make any changes. When you do this work, you have to make the personal changes if you want to have results, if you want to have success.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to that decision-making process that's a mental process. And when you make those changes and you really revamp your lifestyle and you eat the way we're supposed to eat, and again, there's some individuality in there that you can sort out, and exercise, you know, and develop, cultivate a healthy lifestyle, it pays dividends in spades. I mean, it's wonderful. I mean, it's been a very rewarding area to work in. And naturally, some people get into it and they're just not cut out for it. And they realize that and they just drift away, which is perfectly fine. I respect a person's decision, you know, regardless of whether I agree with it or not.
But a lot of it has to do with getting to know oneself, right? And I think that's a very exciting job on the planet.
I do, too. I think that's really the job on the planet.
Well, tell me this, before we have to end here. How do you think people are doing, like en masse, how do you think we're doing proportionally pulling ourselves out of the sway of the market and beginning to really figure out what works for me rather than what's being pumped through the media at me or through ads?
Yeah, well, I'm optimistic because so many people are making these changes now. I mean, look at how big the alternative health industry has become.
Yeah, it is humongous, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember in the 70s, it was like we were like a voice in the wilderness, you know?
we were the weirdos. I remember that.
Yeah. I think it was Emerson who said, if everybody thinks you're crazy, you're probably headed in the right direction.
I know.
I mean, I can buy into that because nothing much has transpired that's been really innovative and wonderful for a lot of people that hasn't been out of the box, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, we get into the things like GMOs or, you know, how the food has been fixed up so it lasts a long time. What am I trying to, preservatives and all that kind of stuff. People are really paying attention to that these days, I believe.
Oh, yes. In fact, in today's article by Joe Mercola, who's a doctor in Chicago, who many people know of his website, Mercola.com, M-E-R-C-O-L-A, Mercola.com, the number one alternative health website in the world. And Joe writes great articles. In fact, even before the computer, he used to write for Townsend Newsletter, which is right here, Port Townsend, another Seattle, you know, offshoot, which was the publication of the alternative industry. I mean, everybody in the alternative health field was waited for their Townsend to come every month in the mail, you know. And Dr. Mercola always wrote an article in there and was really, I always turned his articles first and read them because he had such good insight clinically about treating different conditions and working with different things. And in his article today, he has a free website service that will email you health articles.
Oh, wow, I better check him out. I've never looked at it.
Oh, you never went to Mercola.com. Yeah,
I did not. I'm going to, though.
And today's article was about how science has become bastardized, criminalized, how reports like that are contrary to the industry just get squashed, how results are interpreted totally in favor of the industry, regardless of what the real conclusion is. And it's really a good read if you want to see what's happened with science. The industries have taken it over. There is no more neutral science like you used to get at universities because it's all funded by the industries.
Yeah, it's all about money, isn't it?
It's all about money, unfortunately. And the alternative community isn't immune from that because you have expenses with supplements, you have expenses with a good diet, you know, you have expenses with doing alternative health too. So there's definitely an economic reality to the alternative health industry too.
Yeah, but I think it's really, really, it shows in you and many, many other pretty staunch practitioners that they have to drop inside regularly and test themselves for whether they're being in truth, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's really what it's about. So, Jim, tell people, first of all, I want you to tell me you're going to come back and we're going to deal with mental health, and because I'm really excited about that. And how can people get hold of you? And do you have a website that they can check out?
You know, I just use my email address. We're actually putting together a website. I think I'm the last person in the United States not to have a website, but we're actually working on that now. But just my email address is my last name, Emke, which is spelled E-H-M as in Mary, K-E, E-H-M-K-E, the number 5 at AOL. And then locally here, it's 360-734-9777. But, you know, thinking about future shows, I know we didn't really cover candida properly. We didn't really cover diabetes properly. So there's a lot that has yet to be covered that, you know, we could look at as well.
Well, you would be very exciting as a guest, and I can hardly wait. So let's set it up in the next couple of weeks, and then we'll have a series of podcasts coming up, I think. That will be wonderful for people.
That would be fun. I look forward to that.
Now, tell people quickly about your co-op talk that you're giving on Wednesday night.
Yes, the co-op classes are a 6-week series. The first week is gut health, intestinal health. The second week is immune system health. The third week is hormone health. And in that class, we get into the thyroid, the adrenals, and all the steroid hormones and everything. The fourth class is cardiovascular health. The fifth class is bone health. And then the last class in the 6-week series, which is tomorrow night at the co-op, the Cordata Co-op in Bellingham, is cancer, which is the least popular class. You know, it's always intrigued me. The bone class draws the most people, which is curious. I think you were there. It was pretty much standing room only the other night.
Yes, it was. And it was very... See, the thing about you is you're always just tapping the edge of what you know. It's like you're like the iceberg, you know, a little bit sticking at the top.
That's sweet of you to say that.
It was very exciting to have that much information. I wrote as fast as I could. I learned a lot, and I can hardly wait to come to the cancer one. But I think people are afraid of that, don't you?
Well, everybody's afraid of cancer. It's like the scourge of our culture, you know. And nobody wants to deal with it. But there are really some smart things you can do preventatively, which is what we're going to try to focus on. And then we'll get into some of the alternative therapies that are out there, too. I don't really delve into the medical options and the chemo and all that stuff, but there's a lot you can do preventatively. And even if you're dealing with cancer, there are therapeutic options that you can, you know, avail yourself to if you're so inclined. And that's what we'll talk about tomorrow.
And drop back into just for a sec. I know we're done now, except that I'm thinking of bentonite. The intestinal cleanse must be really helpful as far as cancer prevention.
It is wonderful. I mean, cleaning out the intestinal tract, once again, is instrumental in the overall state of health of the body, including the body's ability to resist cancer.
Wow.
There's some really interesting things about cancer, too, that are absolutely intriguing to me. For example, Dr. Krebs, the famous Dr. Krebs, a German biologist, and his buddy, Dr. Beard, about over 100 years ago, they discovered, and at the time, cancer was not a primary disease. It was a secondary disease. It wasn't, you know, the epidemic that it is now. And they discovered when they analyzed cancer tumors that they were loaded with placenta,
Interesting.
Which is technically called trophoblast or trophoblastic cells. And this is called the trophoblastic theory of cancer. And they knew, because, again, they're world-class biologists, they knew that in embryonic physiology that when the baby's pancreas develops, which the Chinese call the first son because the liver is the father, the spleen is the mother, and the pancreas is the firstborn. Well, of course, the Chinese call it the first son. That when the pancreas develops, it secretes an enzyme called chymotrypsin, which shuts down the growth of the placenta. So that's why the placenta stops growing in a pregnancy. Well, Dr. Krebs and Beard theorized 100 years ago that that might be the key to cancer. That it would be an enzyme deficiency, which allows a cell to start multiplying, and it grows a placenta.
That is interesting, isn't it?
It is. And when in embryonic physiology, you have three basic cell divisions that are occurring. You have somatic cells, which later specialize into glands, tissues, and organs. You have sex, germ, or cancer cells, which are synonymous. They're the same terminology in old-fashioned biology. A cancer cell is a germ cell, is a a sex cell, they're the same thing. And so you have your reproductive cells that are specialty cells, and then you have the placenta. Hmm. Those are the three cells that develop initially. The placenta gets shut down. Well, if this placenta is growing inside of a tumor, Dr. Krebs and Beard theorized 100 years ago that you might be able to shut the growth down with an enzyme, the enzyme particularly chymotrypsin. And that's really what's fueled a lot of the alternative cancer work that's going on. It's beginning with Dr. Kelly, William Donald Kelly, back in the 80s. Care and I studied with him in 77 and became a satellite clinic for Dr. Kelly, who was in Winthrop, Washington.
Wow, really? Good old Washington. I have to say goodbye, not because you're boring, because I can hardly wait for Wednesday night now with this conversation. But we have to say goodnight, and thanks to everyone for listening to Jim Emke in millions of points that you and I can use to increase our health through nutrition. Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
It's been wonderful talking to you.
Likewise.
This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for listening to Paradigm Shifters. There is a lot of change going on out there, and tonight's show was a really good example of how you could be empowered in these crazy times. Thanks for listening. Good night.